shapeless mass of which the prince is the soul. In him resides the thought, the foresight, the principle of all organization, of all progress. On him, therefore, rest all the responsibility. In proof of this assertion, I might transcribe the whole of the 10th book of Telemachus. I refer the reader to it, and shall content myself with quoting some passages taken at random from this celebrated work, to which, in every other respect, I am the first to render justice. With the astonishing credulity that characterizes the classics, Fenelon, against the authority of reason and of facts, admits the general felicity of the Egyptians and attributes it not to their own wisdom, but to that of their kings. We could not turn our eyes to the two shores without perceiving rich towns and country seats agreeably situated, fields that were covered every year, without intermission, with golden crops, meadows full of flocks, laborers bending under the weight of fruits that the earth lavished on its cultivators, and shepherds who made the echoes around repeat the soft sounds of their pipes and flutes. Happy, said Mentor, is that people who is governed by a wise king. Mentor afterwards desired me to remark the happiness and abundance that was spread over all the country of Egypt, where 22,000 cities might be counted. He admired the excellent police regulations of the cities, the justice administered in favor of the poor against the rich, the good education of the children, who were accustomed to obedience, labor, and the love of arts and letters, the exactness with which all the ceremonies of religion were performed, the disinterestedness, the desire of honor, the fidelity to men, and the fear of the gods with which every father inspired his children. He could not sufficiently admire the prosperous state of the country. Happy, said he, is the people whom a wise king rules in such a manner. Fenelon's idyll on Crete is still more fascinating. Mentor is made to say, all that you will see in this wonderful island is the result of the laws of Minos. The education that the children receive renders the body healthy and robust. They are accustomed from the first to a frugal and laborious life. It is supposed that all the pleasures of sense enervate the body and the mind. No other pleasure is presented to them but that of being invincible by virtue, that of acquiring much glory. There they punish three vices that go unpunished amongst other people, ingratitude, dissimulation, and avarice. As to pomp and dissipation, there is no need to punish these, for they are unknown in Crete. No costly furniture, no magnificent clothing, no delicious feasts, no gilded palaces are allowed. It is thus that Mentor prepares his scholar to mold and manipulate, doubtless with the most philanthropic intentions, the people of Ithaca. And to confirm him in these ideas, he gives him the example of Salentum. So we receive our first political notions. We are taught to treat men very much as Oliver de Serres teaches farmers to manage and to mix the soil. Montesquieu. To sustain the spirit of commerce, it is necessary that all the laws should favor it, that these same laws, by their regulations in dividing the fortunes in proportion as commerce enlarges them, should place every poor citizen in sufficiently easy circumstances to enable him to work like the others, and every rich citizen in such mediocrity that he must work in order to retain or to acquire. Thus, the laws are to dispose of all fortunes. Although in a democracy real equality be the soul of the state, yet it is so difficult to establish that an extreme exactness in this matter would not always be desirable. It is sufficient that a census be established to reduce or fix the differences to a certain point, after which it is for particular laws to equalize, as it were, the inequality by burdens imposed upon the rich and reliefs granted to the poor. Here again we see the equalization of fortunes by law, that is, by force. There were in Greece two kinds of republics. One was military.